I'd like to start off by showing you a video because I believe this advertisement sums up the spirit of the age that we're living in. Thank you. Okay, so the sound wasn't absolutely crucial to that particular ad. The point I want to draw out here is the physical mobility of these dancers. Now, the physical mobility symbolizes the expansive possibilities of the self in a world that's dedicated to individual freedom. So having options, having opportunities, being free to do what you want, being free to do, being free to move as you wish, basically being free. So this ad for the iPod celebrates the individual as a free, autonomous, self-expressed individual. And we see these qualities expressed in the way that they can, as I said, move any way they wish. Now, Apple is second to none in the way that it links its products with this sense of freedom, creativity, mobility, flexibility, and above all, individuality. Which is why Dale Keane, when he was developing his theory of the iWorld, looked to Apple in order to name the world that we are living in, the iWorld, where I is individual. Now, this is a contrast to the previous world, which Dale Keane calls the T world, T for tradition. In a traditional society, your life, it was like you were in a big river, let's say, because you just were carried along by the course. What you might do for a living, who you might marry, where you would live, the things that you could expect for your life were largely predetermined. You just were carried along by the current. So in what Keane calls the T world, your identity was essentially given to you as a result of your religion, your tribe, your culture. In some ways, we can see a picture of this in the film Avatar, which is this strange kind of mix of iWorld and T-World. It's iWorld because Jake, the main character, is going off to find himself, but it's a T-World situation because he becomes part of the tribe. And this image also shows us an aspect of the T-World where relationships of obligation and duty were most important in life. You understood your role in a wider story. That's the T-World. But if traditional societies were like rivers, then modern societies are like oceans. You can go where you want. There isn't a necessary direction that you have to follow. You can sink or swim. So in the I world, we're actually free to do as we wish, contrasted with the T world, where we were bound by relationships of obligation and duty. The decline of T world commitments mean that we're now in the business of going it alone, forging our own path for ourselves and seeking our individual fulfillment. So we know why. Well, it's because in the I world, we've become disillusioned with the T world ways of understanding the world. The way that the T world said God, the nation, family, duty, these are the big things that structure your life and give you meaning, and it's what you are supposed to give your life to. In contrast to that, the I world is a place where identity is an act of individual will. Self-definition, Keane says, is the right of every person. We are to be the authors of our own lives. So in contrast to the T world, where doing your duty was most important, we're now in the I world, where it's about following your dreams, okay, reaching your full potential. So the I world exhorts, it prioritizes individual freedom. And in doing so, it exhorts us to, firstly, to create ourselves, to craft our identities for ourselves. Keane says that the I world is continually encouraging us to be ourselves, to find ourselves or create ourselves. And in asking us to create ourselves, it's also telling us to choose well. Because the I world places such a high premium on individual freedom and assumes a rational self that's capable of choosing well, it calls us to be enterprising selves who make an enterprise of their lives. So the enterprising self will be rational, calculating, self-directed, flexible, autonomous, and empowered through their freedom of choice, kind of like the dancers that we saw in the iPod commercial. Now, this state of affairs should be of great interest to Christians today because it shows the I-world context that faces the gospel, and it calls for the need for an everyday theology that can demonstrate the relevance that the gospel has for everyday life. So everyday theology, this comes from the work of Kevin Van Hooser. You've got a definition on your handout, but another way that we can simply explain this is, well, everyday theology is the biblically faithful attempt to understand everyday life, to see life the way that God sees it, and with his help, to be an agent of redemptive change. So what it does is it brings the Bible into conversation with the world, thereby showing the significance of the gospel. And it does this by doing two things. Firstly, it identifies and understands the values that are communicated in the stuff of everyday life and how we are persuaded to adopt such values. Secondly, it points to how Jesus challenges those values in some cases and fulfills them in others. So this exercise helps us to imagine how we might live with eternity in mind instead. Now, there are three principles of everyday theology. Firstly, we have a ruler on the PowerPoint because God's word is the standard against which all practices are measured. The gospel changes the way that we view life. As Ken alluded to earlier, Romans tells us that we are not to be conformed to the pattern of this world, but be transformed through the renewing of our minds. So that's the first principle, the fact that God's word is the standard against which everything else gets measured. Secondly, everyday theology assumes that culture actually shapes us into being particular people, which is why I've got the image of a budding plant life. Okay, it's growing us into particular kinds of people. Van Hooser says, every part of life signifies something about the values and the beliefs that shape culture. Another way of saying this is that the stuff in our everyday life reveals the ways that we are in the world. It actually tells us stories. Stories about the world that we live in, you know, what it values, what it doesn't, what is important, what isn't, and then who we are in relation to that world. So consequently, these cultural stories are always telling us the answers to the following questions. What's the good life? Who should I be? Who am I? What should I strive for? So I'm arguing today that we need to listen in on our culture, to hear the stories it's telling us about the I world, because if we don't do this, then we can uncritically accept its values that are, you know, quite frequently out of step with God's kingdom. The third principle of everyday theology is that in order to be effectively communicated, the gospel needs to be contextualized. So what I mean by this is that there's one gospel, but there are many ways of communicating it. The gospel in this sense needs to be couched in everyday terms that can be understood by people. It actually needs to meet people where they're at rather than expecting them to come to us. So in order to be effective, everyday theology needs to be on the lookout for the fears, the hopes, and the dreams that drive people, and they're going to be different for different types of people. Paul Hebert observes that in each culture, Christians face new questions for which they must find biblical answers. And in order to work out what questions you need to ask, Paul Tillich suggests that you think about, you know, what's the greatest anxiety of this world and what's the greatest hope? Because that'll help you work out how you might use the gospel to answer those questions. Now, let's move on to this idea of makeover culture and body projects. I said before that the I world tells us to choose well as we create ourselves. Now, this means that we view our lives as opportunities to make something of ourselves, to achieve our dreams and our goals. So there's this sense in the I world that we shouldn't be limited by what came before. You know, I always laugh when Julie Gillard talks about aspirational Australians, because this whole thing about the I world shows that we are all aspirational. We're all seeking to change our lives, to increase our chances to be better than what we were before. Because we take it as a given that we are to improve ourselves, right, and create ourselves in line with what we want. We all want to be mobile, upwardly mobile. Now, this idea of mobility is actually key to the I world. Zygmunt Bauman, a sociologist, regards tourism as a metaphor for contemporary life. He says that our lives are marked by mobility and impermanence, a sense of looseness to looseness of ties to place and people. In his words, we graze rather than put down roots. So what he means by that is that we have this endless sampling of experience and a constant search for meaning, satisfaction and fulfillment. But this sense that you don't need to be committed to one ideology, one belief system, you can kind of just mix and match, choose as you will. So this is a very postmodern activity, right? It's the whole idea of pluralism. You can just take from each belief what you like and then make it into something meaningful for yourself. One writer described postmodernism as a spazzy free-for-all, and that really does capture the flavour of what we're talking about today. So as I said, this is a mix and match of different styles, philosophies, belief systems, etc., and the way that we devise our own meaning from that, because we're disillusioned with the T-world's big stories of God, nation, family, duty, etc., that we feel no longer really cut it for us anymore. So there's no more capital T truth, right? There's many little truths, all in undercase. There's no one way to live, the I world says. Everyone can decide for themselves. So in the I world, we believe that people should follow their dreams, right, to define themselves and not be held back by other people's expectations. And we can see that many of us are focused on getting the most we can out of life to become the best possible version of ourselves. Sorry, Kurt, can I have another? Just this is the last video. Now, I wonder if you know that there's a new reality TV show called The Shire, right? So if the audio doesn't come on very well for this, then I'll repeat what they say. But this is just a promo that Channel 10 ran in relation to this show.
8 o'clock Monday. Meet Sophie and Vanessa from The Shire.
I don't like the natural look. To be honest, babe, and I know a lot of girls don't want to hear this, I love looking fake.
I do too.
If you weren't born with her, she's fine.
It's the show that'll get the whole country talking. The Shire starts 8 o'clock Monday on 10.
Okay, thank you very much. So Sophie and Vanessa, one of them says to the other, I don't like looking natural. The other girl says, oh, yeah, absolutely, I like the fake look. And then she actually she goes on saying, if you weren't born with it, just buy it. Now, it's easy to laugh at this particular aspect of Sydney tribalism, in a way. But in some senses, we all live as though we need to work on our lives and to improve ourselves. Makeover is an essential feature of everyday life. We can see that in the proliferation of fitness programs, advertising. There are, you know, budget planners on the internet. So if you need to learn how to manage your money better, you can download tools that can, you know, train you up to do that. YouTube, I also recently discovered, has these channels called eHow and Howcast that show you everything that you want to know. Okay, from how to apply makeup if you have Asian eyes, to how to truss a chicken, how to take a good Facebook photo, how to do all these kinds of things. So how to has become a defining feature of everyday life in the West. Now, I know what you're thinking. It's just for girls, right? Not so much. I want to show you these two covers because notice the similarities between them, right? So not just women are learning, you know, 50 ways to seduce a man, but men are also learning or being told to learn that they need to build a beach body. Now, Maggie Hamilton observes that magazine covers tell us a great deal about how we see girls, how we see guys as well, how they should look, how they should behave, what they should aspire to. Okay, you want to think about everyday theology in the I world, think about how these magazines speak to what's important in our world. Now, these particular magazines are interesting in their focus on the body. Okay, the body actually has a very important role in the I world. In some ways, it is the raw material out of which we are to fashion our lives and our identities. As Rosalind Gill says, the body has become a new identity project in postmodernity. So the body is something to work on, to improve, to develop in line with who you feel you are on the inside. And it's because, you know, our individual identity no longer derives from those T-world sources of meaning, the tribe, the culture, the religion, etc. So in the I-world, we just work on, you know, what we have, which is our bodies. So in the I-world, we start to look at our bodies with a cosmetic gaze. Now, this is a gaze that looks at bodies in the context of their improvement. Okay, so we have on the right-hand side some examples of this. The top image shows a girl who's there's two photos of her. Her freckles in the left-hand photo have been erased to produce the right-hand photo. Okay, so this is like a Photoshop, a fairly superficial cosmetic adjustment. And down below, we've got a girl who's gone and had like a makeover. So she goes from being quite ordinary to looking like a model. And obviously, these are more benign ways, I suppose, of the cosmetic gaze. There's also, of course, the idea of cosmetic surgery, of actually changing your body, getting interventions, getting makeovers in that sense. Now, makeover reality TV shows actually train in us this idea of the cosmetic gaze. It wants to train us to see our bodies in this way. Tiffany Hall, who watches The Biggest Loser here? Some people, a handful of people. Okay. Now, Tiffany Hall trains the white team in The Biggest Loser, and she gives us a fascinating insight into makeover culture. This is a quote that came out of an interview that she did earlier this year. She says, "My training sessions are like interviews. Why are you here? What do you want to achieve? What are you feeling now?" They need to be honest. They need to admit that when they look in the mirror, they don't like what they see. So what she's showing us in this quote is what I call the do-it-yourself ethos of makeover culture. Okay, and in this quote, we can see a three-step process to making over your life. Firstly, where are you now? Okay, presumably she's thinking that the contestants will train the cosmetic gaze on themselves and say, well, right now I'm unhappy with the way that I look. I'm not as fit as I would like to be. I don't feel confident. And I kind of want to do something about it, right? And then she says to them, well, where do you want to be, right? You want to be, presumably, slim. They want to be healthy. They want to have a better chance at, you know, achieving their goals. And they feel they can do that with a body that, you know, works for them. And thirdly, what are they going to do about it? So she's relying on their dissatisfaction with who they are in order to fire and motivate their training. So essentially, they're committing to hard work, right? Because it's their effort that's going to change their life. Now, in the literature on makeover culture, hard work is often mentioned. It's actually identified as a moral virtue of the makeover self, because giving over to a makeover is not just about sitting back and letting it all happen to you. It's about you putting in the effort and you deserving it in the end. So a lot comes down to individual effort. The do-it-yourself ethos promotes this idea that success, whether that's a good figure, no cellulite, you know, better fitness, a new life, is actually yours if you want it badly enough. And you have to admit, this approach gets results. This is the 2010 The Biggest Loser winner, Emma Duncan. And you can look at that and say, that's a pretty incredible transformation. Her hard work paid off. She looks fantastic, right? Now, not everyone has access to reality TV to make over their lives. But the young people that you're in contact with all have access to Facebook, or they will one day. And in some ways, Facebook acts like your own personal makeover show. So let's spend some time thinking about Facebook. So Facebook is, of course, that social networking site that allows you to connect and to share with people in your life. Research has shown that approximately half of the 10 million Facebook users in Australia are between 18 and 35. So half the population of Australia is on Facebook and it occupies that age bracket. So what are they doing on Facebook? Presumably they're finding old school friends, they're posting their holiday pictures, they're keeping in touch with overseas friends and family. Maybe they're getting a job. Maybe they're joining a cause, like supporting activism. Maybe they're also spying on people that they like, right? What they're doing as well, along with all that, is building their profile on a platform that encourages us to package our identities in such a way that emphasizes our good points and downplays our negative points. Stephen Marsh wrote a fascinating article about Facebook in The Atlantic recently, and he describes it as, you know, when you build a profile, you are curating the exhibition of the self. So you're choosing what's going in, what's going to be left out, and how you want to position and show yourself in a particular light. So when this comes to your profile information, it's about thinking, well, what are you proud of? What can you brag about, essentially? How do you position yourself in such a way as to show that you're worth investing in? It's almost like a personal CV. When it comes to your newsfeed and timeline, it's about, you know, looking popular, looking attractive and social, maybe travelling to exotic places or going out to fancy restaurants and checking in, showing people that you're going to places and you're living your life. On Facebook, it's also about posting to your timeline often and showing that you're actually interested and invested in always keeping in touch with other people that way. Maybe you want to delete posts as well that negatively impact your image. And of course, Facebook is also about having lots of friends, because of course, having lots of friends confirms how fantastic you are, right? Now, on Facebook, photos act as a particular kind of social currency, okay? It's actually proof, in some ways, of someone's high status. Ari Schwartz did some research into an Israeli social networking site that's very similar to Facebook, and he actually found, through doing interviews with the users of this site, that having good-looking friends makes the individual more attractive to other people. So in some ways, you know, if your friends are particularly attractive, then that rubs off onto you. So if you can be seen in their photos, for example, of them living the high life, then that's like, hey, doing pretty well. Photos also act as a particular kind of social currency because it's about taking a good picture. Okay, now does this experience resonate with you? Or do you have maybe kids or students that you've seen doing this? Amber Davidson's MySpace homepage contains 5 self-portraits created by pointing the camera toward herself, arm outstretched. She composed each shot so that the arm holding the camera is invisible. In one, the 19-year-old Amber wears a black and white spaghetti strap dress and peers up winsomely at a camera over her head. It took about 15 tries to get it right, she said. I don't want people to think I'm sitting there taking all these pictures of myself, even though I kind of am. Okay, so it sounds pretty ridiculous, right? Now, I know what you're thinking. You're like, oh, man, Generation Me. They're all a narcissistic bunch. Well, you know, can you blame them, considering that we've got Facebook that encourages you to create your profile in such a way? So what we see Amber doing is taking the helicopter shot, right? A shot from above that, you know, takes away the danger of double chin, okay? So you're not like this, it's like that. And, you know, you're getting it right. And, you of course, you're going to get your arm out of the way because you don't want other people to think that you're taking photos of yourself. That's just vain. So the idea here that I'm trying to make is that the Facebook self-portrait insists on this idea of mastery over one's image, a control over the way that you want to be perceived. So in that vein, is it any surprise that we delete or untag ourselves from unflattering pictures? Now, have you ever done that? Have you ever deleted? Maybe this is more for the girls, perhaps. Have you ever deleted or untagged a Facebook image? Have you ever photoshopped a pimple out? I have, yep. There's also, if you're interested in this sort of thing, you can go on YouTube and they've actually got videos of Facebook shots where they've compared the before and after, and you can see some really interesting Photoshop jobs. People actually, you know, wiping out pounds, like wiping out their bellies so they look slimmer on their Facebook profiles. And it's also, of course, in terms of photos as social currency, it's also about a sense of corporeal capital. Okay, that's just a really fancy way of saying what body markers do you have that give you a certain status. Maybe you've got a tattoo and you can show that to us, or you've got a piercing. These are all ways to accrue status and get attention on Facebook. Now, Susie Freeman Green wrote an article for the Sydney Morning Herald on Facebook last year. And she reflected that when she first got on Facebook, she really enjoyed it because it was about reconnecting with old school friends. It was very social and exciting. But then slowly, she writes, she started to feel like I was hovering around people with cooler, more exciting lives. That's a quote from her. It's not me, okay? Now, what's interesting about Susie Freeman Green's experience is that she's an adult, but somehow through Facebook, she's back in the playground. And everything fun about school is there, right? Hanging out with your friends, seeing what's happening, sharing your lives, maybe flirting, all that sort of thing. But if everything fun about school is there, then so is everything that is soul-destroying. What is hot, what isn't, who's in, who's out. So how does everyday theology speak to Facebook? So on your handout, you've got two columns. On the left-hand column is basically the method, I'm saying, of everyday theology, a three-step process. And on the right-hand side is just some observations about how the gospel speaks into that. So our first step with everyday theology is you have to identify the appeal of the text that you're looking at. And when I say the word text, I'm not talking about a piece of writing, okay? I'm talking about the sample from everyday life that we're looking at. And in that sense, we're looking at everything that we could in the world. We could look at a basketball court as a text, for example. How does it make meaning? How do we know that we have to put the ball there and not out this way, for example? So the text in this case is Facebook. What does it say about itself? What is its appeal as well? So with Facebook, you know, I've already alluded to this, the appeal and also what it says about itself, it's a platform that's just about connecting people, right, and helping them share their lives with each other. We can also observe that Facebook, its appeal in some ways, it's about granting ordinary people attention. Now, Peter Harcher, who's the Sydney Morning Herald's international political editor, wrote an article on Facebook last year, and he observed that social networking sites give ordinary people the kind of attention that in the past could only be enjoyed by the famous or the freakish, right? Think of those traveling carnival shows. So he says that these social networking sites give people a satisfying sense of existential recognition. This idea that you are important, you matter, you know, we recognize that you're there. So what this can do is it can identify the need to feel validated, to feel admired, understood, and popular. And you can imagine that teenagers and young people definitely feel that particular pressure. Secondly, with everyday theology, we are identifying the values that we see operating in the text. We are asking, well, what story does this text tell us about what it means to live a good life? What values does it position us to accept? What is its greatest anxiety and greatest hope? On Facebook, in terms of the story that it tells us about life, we can see the importance of looking good, the importance of being popular, being in the know, being fashionable, being part of the in crowd. In terms of its values, we can see that status is valued, so is power, influence, popularity, even though this might produce a sense of competition with other people. We can also see that Facebook values control over the way that you are presented and how you present yourself. In terms of the greatest anxiety of Facebook, I've already alluded to that with the story from Susie Freeman Green. Her greatest anxiety that we can see in this is that someone is always cooler, smarter, whatever, than me. Also, the greatest anxiety is this sense, you know, I can't win at this popularity contest. I'm not valued the way that I am. But if that's the greatest anxiety, then the greatest hope would be, well, I matter. That I want to be valued for who I am, not for who I present myself to be. The third step of everyday theology is offering the gospel's response. So in this sense, we're asking, well, how does the gospel answer the text's greatest anxiety and fulfill its greatest hope? And in light of that, how might Christians respond? The answer is, okay, well, in terms of how does the gospel answer the text's greatest anxiety and fulfill its greatest hope, we would say that your identity and your worth needs to be found in God, right, rather than in your social status or in the opinions of other people. Now, I'm going to explore this idea through the work of Mark Sayers. He has this theory of the vertical self and the horizontal self, okay? The vertical self is where you're finding your identity and your worth in God. The horizontal self is when you're looking at other people in order to give you value. So the horizontal self, as I said, looks to other people for a sense of identity and self-worth. And they do this because there is an absence of that wider story that gives people meaning in the world. So in some ways, like the tea world, right? It's big stories of meaning that gave structure and shape to individual lives. We no longer have that in the I world, and so we're just left to look at each other in order to derive a sense of meaning. So the horizontal self works on themselves in order to live up to the standards of their culture or their peers, and they receive status as a reward or a punishment if they get it wrong. What we can observe about the work of the horizontal self is that it never ends. What's in right now doesn't stay the same, but always changes. And secondly, you know, there's always more to work on. You never reach the, you know, final ideal self where you're absolutely satisfied. Changing ourselves, if we're horizontal selves, never manages to silence the inner critic that we have. Now, when I say inner critic, I'm talking about the little voice inside that says it isn't good enough. And that's what driven athletes will say. It's what straight-A students will say in their head. It's what women say to themselves as well, whether you're mothers or not, okay? It's not good enough. Now, an example of this, Naso Athanasopoulos. He was on Insight a couple of weeks ago. They were doing a program on, it was called Massive Obsession. It was about young men who are really caught up in a bodybuilding culture and they're in this pursuit of, you know, an ideal body. And you can say, looking from the image, that, you know, his body's pretty incredible, right? It's obviously shown great attention and care to his diet and also to his workout. Now, he was quite interesting. He said on Insight, "I think I look okay. You can always get better. There's always room for improvement. But for now, I think I do look good." Now, we can say that, sure, he's saying that because he doesn't want to be vain on national television and say, "I look fantastic." But at the same time, I wonder if he is haunted by this idea that there's always something about himself that he wants to change and that needs improvement. Now, the horizontal self, as I'm sure this guy is insecure because you never feel like you've made it, no matter how hard you work, no matter how hard you try. And let's take a step back and think, you know, if we were living in the 19th century, for example, and just say we were all men and we all got rich, maybe we would commission an artist to come and paint us in all our finery. Okay, we put the rich silks on, surround ourselves with all our possessions, and then get an oil painting done. Now, generations later, perhaps today, this portrait of you might hang in someone's house or maybe in a museum somewhere. It actually captured you at your best and was the final word on your success. Today, with Facebook and our makeover culture, there is no final word. You can always look better. Stephen Marsh observes this when he says, "What's truly staggering about Facebook is the constancy of the performance it demands." Among 18 to 34-year-olds, he says, nearly half check Facebook minutes after waking up, and almost 30% do so before getting out of bed. Facebook never takes a break. We never take a break. So I don't know about you, but I listen to what he says and I'm like, man, that life is exhausting and stressful because, you know, it's all up to your individual effort to check in all the time, to show that you're active and incredible and doing and living your life in the way that you want to. So it's stressful and exhausting because it's all up to you to do that. Okay. Now, if you remember Emma Duncan, I don't know if I have a picture. No. If you remember Emma Duncan, the Biggest Loser winner, we celebrate her success and her hard work at transforming her life. At the same time, do you remember any of the other contestants from that year? I can't even remember any of them. I don't even know what they look like. What happens to them? Did they not try hard enough when it came to transforming their lives? Did they not deserve it enough because they didn't work hard enough? Now, this is one of the problems with the I world and the way that it glorifies the individual and particularly individual effort. Because the glory is all ours to enjoy if we succeed, but it's very crushing if we happen to fail. We have to, in other words, accept full responsibility for our lives. And that's a good thing as well. Okay? It's good to take responsibility for your life. But at the same time, it tends to assume that we're all on this equal playing field when we're not. Things like poverty, things like sexism, racism, homophobia, all of these are structural forces that mean that we're not on an equal playing field. The odds are stacked against some people more than others, simply as a function of birth. So there's no equal playing field. And yet the I world says, if you're good enough, you will make it. End of story. Everyone's equal, no excuses. A horizontal life, we can also observe, is lonely. Because in some ways, other people are potential competition rather than allies. I wonder what C.S. Lewis would make of Facebook. He writes in Mere Christianity, "We say that people are proud of being rich or clever or good-looking, but they are not. They are proud of being richer or cleverer or better-looking than others. It's the comparison that makes you proud, the pleasure of being above the rest." And I think he makes a really good point. In some ways, clever is meaningless unless you compare it to people who are less clever or not as clever as you. So in the I world, we tend to celebrate this idea that people who have made it to the top, it's because they've, you know, separated themselves from the pack and distinguished themselves, and that's why they can sit at the top of the heap. So we observe here that the I world that prioritizes the individual at all else is damaging to community. That's the life of the horizontal self in a nutshell. The vertical self, however, locates their worth and their value in God. And they can do that because they believe that there is a wider story that structures who we are and that frames all our endeavors in the world. Now, for the Christian, this is the gospel. The self-worth and identity of the Christian is grounded in the love and acceptance of a gracious God rather than the opinions of other people or the standards of success, beauty, and worth set by our makeover culture. We're here talking about grace. God's love is not based on individual effort as it is in the I world because we can't earn God's favor. He isn't swayed by what's popular, unlike the rest of us who have something to prove. Rather, God loves us freely, not on the basis of what we've done, but on the basis of what Jesus has done. And in doing so, he creates the ultimate level playing field, because it's not based on individual effort, it's simply because of who you are. So God's grace challenges the attitude of our makeover culture, which is that if I try hard enough, I will succeed. With grace, it's not a question of who tries hardest, because deep down, no one deserves grace. God can see us exactly as we are, okay, the best and the worst of us, and he loves us anyway. Now, when I've given versions of this talk to students in school, I always pause at that point and clarify. When I say God can see you exactly as you are and loves you anyway, I'm not saying that you're fine the way you are, okay? You're just a precious snowflake. God loves that precious snowflake that you are. All I mean by that is that we don't need to impress God the way that we do everyone else. Because obviously, you know, God loves you as you are, but he doesn't actually want you to stay like that as well. There are some things about you that are going to have to change. Just wanted to clarify that. So the vertical self relies on God's grace, not on their own efforts. So in some ways, they're not actually controlled by the same value system of the I world. Now, Tim Keller puts it this way in his book, Counterfeit Gods. If your identity and security is in God, then something can't control you through worry and desire. It's one or the other. You either serve God or you become open to slavery to. And I wonder whether any of the teenagers or young people that you know would put any of these things in those blanks. Okay, I just want to finish up by telling you a story of two sisters. Firstly, we have Rena, who is very attractive. She's very friendly, she's lovely, really nice girl. And this is her sister, Laurel. These are their Facebook profile pictures, let's say. Now, Laurel has her face down because, particularly in comparison to Rena, she's not that pretty. There's no getting around it, okay? She's lovely, but she's not as good looking as her sister. Now, based on this very, you know, cursory introduction, who's likely to have more friends on Facebook, given the values of our world? The pretty one, yeah? Rena. Okay, now let's imagine for a moment that both of these sisters like a boy. Let's just pretend it's him, okay? Now, Laurel, our girl in the purple hoodie, she knows that she doesn't have a chance. So how do you think she feels? What is she going to do? Is she going to essentially compete with her prettier sister? Or might she say, you know, it really hurts that he doesn't like me, but at least that doesn't determine my worth, which would show that she's in some ways like a bit of a vertical self because she's not basing her worth on other people. Now, if Laurel is actually more vertically inclined than that, if she's Christian, she might even go a step further and say, I am known and loved by God. He is the source of my worth. Now, this is a modern-day version of the biblical story of Leah, Rachel, and Jacob. We can see that Rachel, who's Rena in this illustration, gets the rewards of Jacob's love and devotion. He works a total of 14 years to be able to marry her. And we should note here that it's not just Jacob that is valuing Rachel in this way, but it's also her father, right, who knows that he can actually extract, you know, his pound of flesh from Jacob and yet not do that when it comes to his other daughter, Leah. So in this, and in the biblical story, Leah is the unwanted one. She is the unloved one. Now, all of us know what it's like to feel rejected, okay, to not feel good enough. That feeling drives Leah to compete ferociously, okay, in the only way that was possible for her in that culture. In that culture, having kids was your status symbol, so that's what she decided to do. When she was constantly, you know, wanting to have kids in order to get the edge over her prettier sister Rachel, this makes Leah a bit of a horizontal self. Okay, she's always comparing herself to people around her. However, Tim Keller tells us in his discussion of this story that throughout all her struggles, she's constantly crying out to God, who loves and values her. Her constant appeals to God show her verticality in some senses because God is Leah's ultimate reference point. Now, Leah's story shows that being a vertical self doesn't mean you are completely immune to the horizontal world that we live in. So, of course, you know, you might be vertical, but you might still feel competitive with the people around you and all that sort of thing. However, it does remind you that there's more to your life than what other people think of you. There's more to your life than your rating, okay, and then your status as well. And the young people that are growing up in the I world today, this Christian message that God prizes them and values them is totally contradictory to the message of the I world, where you have to reach a certain level in order to be valued and to be important. So that's the conclusion of my first session. Next session, we'll be looking at how we as Christians are called to live in the I world. Thank you.